What's up, everybody? This is Todd Wilson with another episode of Elevate Your Game. Today, we have a former college player, former pro, now an NBA agent, Mr. EJ. Oh, we're going to start that over. Rewind, but we're actually going to start over. Most importantly, he is a husband and a father.
Yeah, so nice.
Shout out to wifey and the kids. Yeah. Mr. EJ Kushner, welcome to the show.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely, man. All the way out here from Houston, stopping through town to watch a player play, and stops by Elevate Your Game Studio, man. I can't appreciate you more, man, for coming through.
No, man. Thanks for having me. I'm glad this worked out.
Absolutely. We start this show with the Wall of Hoop movies. Your favorite hoop movie of all time, and why?
The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. Number one, because I'm from Pittsburgh, and you know, the city of Pittsburgh doesn't get enough basketball love. But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty quirky movie. It's probably the reason that a lot of people haven't seen it, but you know, Dr. J's in it, and you know, the background really is that it's a struggling franchise. You have Dr. J's character as a star player, but they're losing a lot. And they have this like kind of crazy idea to turn to like astrology, where they only sign players who are Pisces. So they change the name from the Pittsburgh Pythons to the Pittsburgh Pisces. You know, and like many of these movies, they go on to have a great deal of success, just based on you know, kind of this weird out of the box idea.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool just to see a hoop movie from his time, right? Flip Wilson's in there, like just some funny stuff.
Yeah, and like for me too, it's like, so like, you know, shout out to the Gambridge brothers. Like, you know, these are guys that like were my dad's friends growing up that had made like cameos in the movie. You know, and it's got like a deep kind of like disco cultural piece of it too, where it's like what, late 70s-ish, you know,
yeah,
vibe. So
no, crazy. So when did you fall in love with basketball?
Oh man, it's like one of those things where it's like I don't even know that I can remember. Like I was around my dad. Like my dad was in the basketball business. He was in the shoe business. And you know, he's taken me to games, to All-Star games. He worked with NBA athletes, NFL, MLB athletes. So I think it was just like, I was always going with him, and that was his work. But for me, it was like, man, this game, it's amazing, right? So I'm going to camps, and he's got the little hoop, and I'm out there going and doing dunks and doing, kind of almost like exhibitions at different camps, West Virginia, Pitt, all these different places, like locally, because I grew up in Pittsburgh. So yeah, I mean, most of these, like, I just wanted to be like my dad. You know, I got to see him and his friends and his college teammates and those relationships. And
that's, your dad played as well?
He did. He played at Kansas State. He was then drafted in like the 10th, I think it's like the 10th round, Kansas City, Omaha Kings at the time. He didn't end up playing in the NBA or the ABA. He went to camp with the San Diego Conquistadors, who were in the ABA, and actually, you know, he was in camp and they made a coaching change, and they actually brought in Wilt Chamberlain as player coach. And Wilt brought in like guys with him to camp. So it's kind of like four or five guys are coming in.
Politics.
But there's this newspaper article that says, you know, Wilt comes, Ernie goes, from like the Akron newspaper. He's from Akron, Ohio. So that's like not a cool story probably in the moment, but like, you know, looking back on it. And I don't think Wilt ended up lasting very long, like as a player coach in San Diego, which was always the irony of like, my dad was like, dang, like he came in and then it wasn't like he even stayed, and then he played professionally in Israel and Brazil. So I think that goes back to like my love of the game, is just being able to see like, you know, that legacy that was before me.
Man, tell me about Pittsburgh youth basketball. What was it like growing up? Like, I know you were being around the game, the camps and all that, but just talk about, you know, the competitiveness and the focus on something like basketball.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of goes against like my whole probably argument that basketball is a Pittsburgh city. I'd say it's emerging in that, because when I was a kid, like, it was all about like football. So to have this goal and this dream, like I went to high school with guys that were high major football. So there wasn't really like a lot of examples of players who were going and playing high major. But there was guys around, like at the park, like there was a guy, Pete Sauer, who played at Stanford, who was really good. Brandon Foose Cheatham. So like when I was a kid, like his dad would run these clinics at down at Trees Hall, which was like right there where Pitt is. And so that's really where I was like honing my skills and doing drills, but it was like a very small group of like players, like Pittsburgh area. And then Brandon ended up going to, he was a top 50 player. He played at Ohio State. So kind of had that to look up to, I guess. But I would say really like my journey changed when I was like in sixth grade, 12 years old. So my dad was doing stuff with the New York Gauchos. So the Converse were the main sponsors. And I thought I was pretty good. Like I had gotten to the place where like, you know, I was killing in our local leagues, and he was kind of trying to be like, hey, you got to keep working. Like you're not as good as you think you are, in like a very fatherly way. And he's like, you know, kind of, you want to play Division I basketball, if you want to be a pro one day, here's the things you got to do. And I was kind of like, I wasn't working maybe as hard as I should, or wasn't as focused. And he was like, okay. So instead of like really kind of like, you know, hammering me on like you're not good enough, he just took me to New York City with him. And just like we went to the Gaucho gym, and I remember we spent the weekend playing, and he didn't have to say anything. right, like when we got in the car, when it was time to fly back and go home to Pittsburgh, he was like, so like you still think you're good enough? And I was like, no, not at all. Like I recognized, like, all right, I can shoot the basketball. But like, man, I'm like struggling to get this thing over half court. Yeah. You know, I'd never been pressed in our leagues, like, you know, suburban leagues in Pittsburgh. It's like, you can't press, you couldn't do these certain things. And so I was like, man, I gotta get better. Cause there's all these other guys out there. Like I'm competing, I'm not competing with the pool of players here in my small youth league. I'm competing with, you know, the whole country, probably world, really, to get these spots, and there's only so many of them. Yep. So that really changed my perspective on everything.
So how did that change your work ethic?
Oh, I mean, greatly, right? So like, I really locked in and took that serious. So I had the, I had the Pistol Pete videos, the what is it, homework basketball or whatever it was. Yep. I forget the exact name of it, but you had that, and then you had Gannon Baker. Like Gannon Baker was just kind of coming onto the scene, so I had like. It was the PT is up to you was his whole thing. And so my dad had been doing some stuff with Converse with him. And so I had his videos. So I was just going out in the driveway and just like going and watching these videos, and then whatever, you know, you print out the workout or whatever. Yeah. And just started really working.
People don't know that. Like VHSs were our videos,
yeah.
Our trainers. Like we didn't have somebody telling us what to do. We had to listen to Gannon Baker and but more than basketball, like all those people.
Yeah, all those people. There was like this one, there was this guy from Indiana. I couldn't even tell you the name of the coach or the player, but it was like a boy, a ball, and a dream. It was like, again, like this coach and his dad, like showing, you know, the different drills. And some of these drills are now obsolete, right, that we were doing. There's been such an evolution in training for the better. I think there's an argument to be made that maybe there's too diluted, there's too many trainers, but at the end of the day, to me, like the skill of the American player has never been higher, because again, guys are getting training. Now applying that training to like a team setting, there's a conversation and you know that, but yeah, it changed everything, that trip.
Yeah, that's awesome. And when did you, so that was probably pretty much in middle school.
So I was like 12, sixth grade, 12 years old, yeah.
Working your way to high school,
yeah.
Is that probably the biggest jump that you've seen in like your development?
Yeah, well then the other issue too is like I was a late bloomer. So like I was like, I mean, I was like probably, 5'8", 5'9", like I'm 6'5" now. But like going into high school, like I didn't play varsity until I was a junior. So I was playing JV as like a freshman and a sophomore. And I think a lot of that was like, man, I felt like I was behind because I felt like I put so much time into it, but I was like not getting the results the results didn't match the work.
Yeah.
But a lot of that had to do with just the fact that like I just hadn't physically developed. Guys were stronger, they're faster. And then once that growth spurt happened, you know, that's when like all the work that I had been putting in before really kind of, you know, started producing fruit, so to speak.
How important is it for a kid to understand that work ethic piece? Like, or that the seeing the fruits of your labor, right? Because there's a lot of undersized. I was a late bloomer too. I got 6'2" in college.
Like, yeah.
5'9", 5'10", and in college I actually grew. So I understand that as well. And I wasn't the best basketball player I could be until I was like 23 through 27. Like, I was like really good. Like, but all that work, and I worked my butt off. Like, what kind of mindset do I have if I'm a kid in that stage, right? That's where most of these middle schoolers are and freshmen, sophomores are.
Yeah, I mean, I think the consistency is the key. Like, the consistency will eventually pay off. And I think for me, like, I was like fortunate too, because I had my dad and my mom too, just basically being able to like, you know, continue to stay consistent, just like you're gonna win in the end kind of mentality. So like those moments when you're discouraged is like, nah, you just gotta keep going and know that like there is a long game at play. And we see that all the time with players who, I mean, everybody harps on the Steph Curry thing. It's like, but there's so many players out there where that consistency in the end will pay off, right? And every player is going to have a different ceiling. I think that's the thing too, is like there's certain God-given gifts that each player has too that plays into that. But it's like, I always tell guys, like, if you're consistent, you put in the work, you're going to find your ceiling. And if you find your ceiling, then you can be happy with that result.
You know, do you think the ceiling could be moved?
I mean, I guess, but I mean, I guess like there's, again, like when it comes to like size, athleticism, like first of all, size, there's nothing you can do. So like whatever tall you're going to be, that's what tall you're going to be. Like your measurables, those are that's God given. Athleticism, some of these things you can improve, again, marginally.
I think there's science now that where you can become athletic. I mean, you see these guys jumping 50 inches and doing these crazy dunks.
That's true. You got like the knees over.
When we were growing up, we didn't have that.
Yeah.
It was the beginning of the fast twitch movement, right? Where we're all working on our hops and getting those things. And now you can, but everybody can dunk now. Like, what are those separators, right, to move that ceiling? Like, you talk about Steph Curry, and I just look at his ball handling, his IQ and his ability to shoot the ball. Like, are those things, can those be raised? Or is it like, no, Steph Curry also had a dad who played in the NBA, and he was around in his whole
life. Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, there's just so many factors that go into it. And, like, I always look at this, and I tell players this, like, even from, like, an agent side, business side of things, is, like, each player is unique and their journey is unlike any other, right? And you can pull pieces from different players and different examples to apply that can give you, some of that's just like giving you confidence to know that it's been done. What is it, the Roger Bannister example, where it's like the 4-minute mile, I think he was the first one to break the 4-minute mile, and then like after that, it's like what, thousands and thousands of people have done it because the whole mindset of like, oh, it's been done before, it can be done.
Right.
At least that's how my mind worked too, is I was able to look at people that players like, okay, I could I be him? I think I could be him, right? But like there's certain players I think you could look at that, like I couldn't look at Shaq and be like, oh, I could be Shaq. You know what I mean? Like Shaq has a different ceiling than like I did or another player. So I guess to what you're saying, to your point, yes, I think you can raise the ceiling, but there is probably like a
ultimate ceiling.
Ultimate ceiling. Somewhere there's a somewhere there is.
There's a way.
Yeah.
There's a potential that you can reach, and you know, I guess I from a developer standpoint, right? And
yeah,
you know, I'm around a lot of middle schoolers, and so I like to like show them like, hey, it, like you said, the consistency is always going to pay off at the end. You want to be the person who's ranked number one later in life, not earlier in life, but also the little things that you can enhance. Enhance them. That's what's going to raise your ceiling. So,
but to your point, like what you're doing though too is also like getting good information, right? Like these players working on the right stuff, because there's also a window of time when like your ceiling probably can't raise as much, right? So it's like when you're in those like kind of prime formative years where like you are going into middle school or you're, you know, right before high school or even like early parts of high school, is like developing certain habits, but also like knowing what you're working on, why you're working on it, and then how it applies to you being a better basketball player. Because I've been around so many guys too where like they're so good at the drills, right? Like growing up, it's like, oh man, like I can do like the spider dribble and he can wrap the round ball around his, he can do the around the world, whatever these drills were, but then he got into a game and like he
couldn't
play because it just didn't necessarily translate. So I think that's the biggest thing too, is like making sure, you know, that's why what you're doing is like so important too, is like empowering players to know what to work on. Like I didn't, my best trainer, I didn't get until I was a pro. Right, so I look back at that, I'm like, man, if I had this guy as my trainer, like when I was in middle school, oh my gosh, I could have been such a better player. And it wasn't that he would have like, it was like he was unlocking things that I already had that I didn't know how to use. I didn't know how to apply it. And then he was putting me in an environment, Pete Strobel's his name too, I give a shout out to Pete, but like he would put me in an environment where like I was able to fail trying. So that it, like the first time I was trying, it wasn't in a game when there was like something on the line. Like I wasn't gonna get subbed out. I wasn't gonna be get a turnover. It was like, so we'd run through that 10, 20, 30 times. And so now when I got in the game, I was like, oh, I know what to do. I know what this feels like, right? And I feel confident in it, and I feel like I can go and execute it without processing and thinking.
So did you ever go back and play for the Gauchos?
Yeah, I played three tournaments with them.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so like I traveled with them.
You got your get back. So after you, that junior year, or when did you?
No, so this was like when I was 12. So like he took me, we did that weekend, and then we went and played in tournaments in what, North Carolina, Rhode Island, and maybe there was one more. But like I went and actually played with them. So I was on the 12 and under team. And so, yeah, I was traveling with them. We had, you know, Gauchos in the Bronx, man. So we had, you know, Lord Tariq Peter Guns, Uptown Baby was like their anthem. So I'm coming back to Pittsburgh, you know, singing like Uptown, and people are like, bro, what do you, what? But I got thrown into the fire. And to this day, like I've had now clients and friends who were Gauchos, like, Truck Bryant, who played at West Virginia, he's a Gaucho. He's got his, you know, jersey framed on the wall there. So I always would joke with him is that, you know, I was the, you know, he looked up to me as the Gaucho that he wanted to be. You know, I laid the pathway for him. He's always like, no.
No. So high school, what are some highlight points? So I like to do a moment we'll call it the 2-minute drill. Mm-hmm. So from say freshman year of high school through senior year of high school, what's your 2-minute drill of your development and just some highlights of your career?
Yeah, I mean, as a freshman, like I played freshman basketball. So like, again, I went to like a big public high school in Pittsburgh, but like, I think I'm the only one, maybe one of two, like up until that point that had gone to play Division I basketball. So like, it wasn't a thing. Right, so for me, I'm saying that as like I was playing freshman ball on a team that had nobody that was playing college basketball, and if they were, it was like, you know, Division III. And I had like knee issues growing, so like that freshman year, super frustrating because I wasn't able to like really play to my full capabilities. Sophomore year, I'm playing JV. Again, you're looking around at your peers, the guys that you're playing with AAU, they're playing varsity, they're starting varsity, and like you're playing JV. And so, again, there's like some insecurities and some things that come with that. But that ultimately ended up being, you know, good for my overall development because I was playing at the level that I should have been playing at. And I think sometimes we want to get ahead of ourselves, we want to play up, or we want to be on varsity, or we want to be at that next level. But it's just to say that we're at that level, not because it's actually where we're supposed to be. And then, yeah, as a junior, leading the varsity team in scoring. So I literally went from playing JV to being our leading scorer as a junior and senior. And nobody was talking about or remembering that, you know, that as a sophomore or freshman, what you were doing. And again, I didn't have like a super high level of recruitment. It had a very up and down, you know, junior and senior year. junior year, actually had a, we went on a trip to California and made bad decisions on that trip, you know, that cost, ended up costing us like the playoffs and certain things. So I had to learn a valuable lesson there.
What
kind of,
can we talk about
that? Yeah, we can talk. I mean, we were, underage drinking.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so I remember coming home from that trip.
LA or
San Diego. So it was like Surf and Slam, something, I don't know. And I'd never like really drank before in my life, and so we were out there basically like unsupervised. Like our high school coach was just basically like, he was on vacation too, I guess.
Okay.
And so we kind of like loosely had chaperones, but we were in San Diego just.
Like in the Gaslamp District. Like
yeah, downtown. So we're taking the trolley. We're riding that trolley. You know what I mean? And yeah, we were dumb, young, and we, like, I remember one of my teammates like went to Ralph's and was like just tried to buy alcohol, or one of the convenience stores, and they were like they just sold it to him. So you know, I mean, and again, but like a valuable lesson of just like how like making bad decisions like. We got suspended, my reputation, all these things. I remember my dad taking all my college letters and just like I'm throwing these, like taking them and being like, I'm throwing these away. Like you want to make decisions like this, but you say you want to play college basketball, like doesn't line up. Mm. Like what's more important? Like, so you kind of just learn the hard way, but I wouldn't say like, I didn't have like a decorated high school career. Like I wasn't all section. I wasn't first team all section. My senior year, which is like to put something behind that, is like the guys that made all section, like one was like a high major football player. One out of those five guys, like none of them went higher than, maybe we had one or two guys on that team that went Division III.
Wow.
That didn't even like, you know, weren't even like high level Division III players. So like for me to not do that and then to kind of have the career that I have, like I guess my main thing to sum all that up would be like, don't get discouraged. You know what I mean? Because it's not over until it's over. So like, keep trying to find different avenues to get to where you want to be. And at least when it's all said and done, you can look back and say, I have no regrets. And that was always my goal. And that's something that my parents always preach, is that like, you get to do this one time in life. My uncle was in Major League Baseball for 50 years. And he used to always tell me, you got one sweet window, one sweet moment in time. He's like, I hit 3 major league home runs. He's like, that ain't something, no one's writing a book about that. Nobody's, you know, making a movie about my 3 home runs, but I can say I hit 3 major league home runs. So when these guys come up to me and say, I could have done this or I could have done this, that, he's like, I did it. He's like, so you want to be able to say that you did it, or at least not be one of those guys that says I could have, would have, should have, because it's this window of time and that's over.
I love that. I love that. All right. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of, I want to say, philosophy I'm going to give my kids. Like, there's a bit of a pressure behind that, but it's a positive pressure, right? That's going to push you to greatness.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't think I don't think anybody's ever even said that, something like that to me to this day. Like, that encourages me to do something right now. Like, God, there's a small window of time. Like,
yeah. Capitalize on something. Because and he was saying that to me. I remember exactly where we were. Like, we were in Pittsburgh. He was coaching for the White Sox, and we were out at dinner. And like all the players were in there, coaches. Everybody's in this restaurant, bar, or whatever at the hotel. And he's like, you know, look around at all these guys. He's like, some of these guys right now are a year or two away from being out of the league, and they don't know it. And he's like, and they're going to be coming back to me, asking me for a job in a year or two. But they've been, but while they're now in the league right now, you know, they're not the greatest people to the people in the organization. And he's like, watch. He's like, when we, this will happen. He's like, it's a cycle. So it's like, it also taught me that lesson of two of like, he's like, treat people the right way while you're doing it. He said, because it's gonna be over. And when it is over, you wanna be able to circle back with people and you want them to remember how you treated them and who you were. When you were, you know, and this wasn't necessarily for me, it's like I played at this super high level, but it is something I share with my athletes. It's like, people remember how you treated them when you were on top. If you don't treat them well while you're on top, don't expect that you can circle back and they'll remember that and they'll be like, I don't wanna help you.
That's good advice, that's great stuff. Mm-hmm. So what happened with college? So in the senior year, like you said, it's up and down, got into a little trouble. mm-hmm. what happens, but what gets you to the next level?
So I went to prep school. Again, at the time, that's just like, that's what I mean by like good information, good knowledge. Like if my dad did not kind of understand the inner workings of it, he would have just said, go to college, this is your best option. But I did a post-grad year. Originally, we were talking about this before the show, I was originally gonna go to Notre Dame Prep. I ended up at the Petty School in New Jersey. You know, the coach got me on campus at Petty, and I was like, man, this is an incredible opportunity. This looks like it's better than, you know, Notre Dame, for me personally. And so my recruitment went from, you know, Division III to, I had Division II offers. And we got to the end of my prep year, and I had a good year. I was, you know, first team all, but they had all state or all Maple or whatever. I had a really solid year, and my best offer was St. Anselm's, really good Division II program. Went on a visit there, enjoyed the visit. And then I remember we got to the spring and I was playing AAU again because I was just trying to get my recruitment up. But this is like prep year spring, which is like crazy. You know, I'm 19 years old at this time playing AAU. Yeah, and I remember
a lot of kids do that now.
Now they do. But at the time, right, it wasn't. And so I remember my prep school coach, who I love, Chris Potash, who I love to death, like still very close with him. He was like, dude, you got to take this D2 offer like right now. Like, what are you doing? Like, it's a scholarship, like, take it. You don't have anything else. We did the prep year. There's no D1 offer coming. And I had another guy, Mike Severlino, who runs this team. It was the New Jersey Cyclones, right? And he came to me and was like, look, I still think I can help you. I still think you can like realize your dream of playing Division I basketball. And so what we did was we went and played the summer circuit, which is like nuts at that point. Like I'm playing the summer circuit after going to prep school. And I had a junior college lined up in the event that it didn't work out. So I think that's the thing also with like players is understanding is like, do you have like a fall, like a real fallback option? Because if you turn down an offer, like it's probably going to be gone and you can't really circle back to it unless, you know, something happens. And I remember he was like, we're going to play you at the point. And I'm like, I'm not a point guard. He's like, yeah, but it's all about the framing of it. He's like, you're going to bring the ball up the court. You're going to get rid of it. Maybe even before you get across half court. And he's like, you're going to run to the corner and you're going to come off a stagger and catch and shoot it. Or you're going to throw it and you're going to come off a flare and you're going to catch and shoot it. Right? He's like, I'm never going to have you like dribbling in the lane or coming off a pick and roll. He's like, but that narrative of like, oh, he's 6'5", he can shoot it. He's a two, but he can also play the one. And it worked. I got one Division I offer, and it was Centenary College in Louisiana, which at the time was the smallest Division I school. I had never heard of it. Robert Parrish went there, was like their claim to fame.
What is it again?
Centenary. It's D3 now. It's not Division I anymore. Yeah. It was in the Mid-Continent, which became the Summit League, and my cousin's junior college roommate was the assistant there. So he saw my name on a list. We were playing at the Milk House in the Super Showcase down in Disney, and you know, they watched me play and they watched the right game, I guess. And it's funny he said that. That was the narrative, was like, oh, you were running point. Like, exactly. And so I give Mike so much credit because, and it's something that I've used even as like an agent now too, is like understand, he was so good at that, like helping guys get to that level. And he was so confident about it, and it wasn't done in like a way where he was like over-promising.
He had a plan.
There's a plan.
No, you're Division I. What is that?
Wow. Yeah, you have to. Yes, he had a plan. He had a plan. He had teams, and then we had a backup plan. So it was like, if you still want to play Division I, you can go this route. You can go to junior college, right? And ironically, St. Anselm's did circle back towards the end of the summer as well. So like, it still was a possibility, but we weren't like necessarily banking on that. So I got that Division I offer, and then, you know, you go to Centenary, and then we were 4-23 my freshman year. I played like, I don't know, less than 7 minutes a game. So it's like, dang, like maybe I'm not a Division I player. Like, am I not? And then coach, you know, I'd go to him and what could I do better? And it just kind of became like clear that like, there was nothing I was gonna do. Like if he told me to rebound more in practice and then I rebounded, I'd go to him and be like, hey, was I rebounding? They're like, yeah, but you need better this. Like it was never giving me like the like anytime I did what I was supposed to do, it was like something else. So I was like, all right, I kind of see the writing on the wall here.
What is that? What is that? Now that you're like, you can look at that now, you have experience now. Yeah. What does that mean when you feel like as a player, you're doing everything your coach is asking you and you're still not earning time on the court?
I mean, I think it's like you first have to have that self-reflection, like, am I doing everything that I possibly can? And then once you are, and this is the hard thing that I had to learn, is like once you start learn to ask the right questions, and I use this now with players as well, like when you learn to ask the right questions, you get the right answers, right? So you can be like, all right, there's nothing I can do here. And so when I got to that place, I was like, all right, what are my options? And my coach, who had recruited me to Centenary, left and was at another school. And I remember we played TCU my sophomore year opening night in, and he was coaching at Dallas Baptist. And I remember he was at the game. My dad's there, extended family. It's a big deal. And I remember after the game, my dad's like, thank God you didn't get in the game. And I'm like, what? Like, I put in so much work. I mean, I do, like, what are you talking about? Everybody's here? Like, it's embarrassing that I didn't get in the game. He's like, no, he's like, you know, he's like, I was talking to Coach Kern, and he's like, you need to redshirt. Like, he's like, he told me, he's like, he basically was like, this coach is never going to play EJ. Like, it's never going to work. It doesn't matter. Like, he's made his mind up on EJ. Mm. And so, like, whoa, so, like, what are our options? Like, redshirt, and then you can go Division II and have 3 years of eligibility, or you can go JUCO.
Right.
And then have 2 years somewhere else. And so what this process taught me was, like, you can kind of, if you know the system, if you understand the system and the rules and how it works, you can kind of keep kicking the can down the road,
yeah.
Right? You can keep allowing yourself the opportunity to get where you want to go. But if you make certain decisions, it cuts off a bunch of different pathways.
Man, no, that's amazing. Like you said, that information, like, man, that's what I wish I had. Right? Like,
yeah, no, I mean, and I look back on it and just be like, man, I'm so, like, I tell people, like, my parents were my original agents, because I'm like, oh my gosh, like, if I didn't know this, if they didn't know this, or they weren't getting information, because my dad knew some stuff, but he was calling his college teammates. We're talking about Bob Chipman at Washburn, huge, big time success as a Division II coach, Lonnie Kruger, who obviously, you know, had a ton of success, you know, Florida, Illinois, UNLV, Oklahoma. He's calling these guys too. And they're in the mix, so they're able to give him good information back, trusted information, and these are like relationships that he had where he could pick up the phone and do that. Yeah. And so,
don't try to be your kid's agent if you don't have those connections. Let's get this.
Yeah, 100%. No. Yes, I don't. Yes, yes.
Because he had the people to speak to.
Yeah, yeah.
About things that he was able to navigate that. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you're going to be your kid's agent and you're an engineer and don't know anything about basketball. Sorry, kind of.
Yeah, no, absolutely, you have to do that. No, but that's what I'm saying. It's like this isn't like a paid plug or whatever, but like having people like you that are there to guide and give information is critical.
This guy, $100.
No, no, but like the difference of that was, is that I did redshirt. I used that year to get so much better. Yeah. And I was so motivated. I actually used to go and do my like individual workouts when I knew the coach was in the office, because the office was right next to the gym. So he could see how much I was working. And then I used to time my workouts before the game when the other coaches from the other teams would be out there. So they'd come out and see me like working out, and then I'd try and, like, I remember Homer Drew, who was coaching at Valparaiso at the time, like coming up to me, I'd go shower real quick, come out, and then there'd be enough time for me to like hit go and like introduce my, I'm like working like.
This is, you're planning it out.
Yeah, you know, and so I just remember, you know, I got like Homer Drew standing there, he's giving me like, you know, advice and wisdom and dropping some Bible verses on me before the game, and then I'm following up with him like via, you know, like I was probably also like wired in a way that was different too, like now that I look back on it. But yeah, then I went to junior college at Collin County, and I had an amazing coach. So I went from having a coach that didn't believe in me to having Jim Sagona, who was the best, you know, and he instilled so much confidence in me too. So like, I don't, you know, you need the right people coming in too. Like you need, I don't believe in luck, but there is such a thing as timing and the people that want to see you win. And I remember there was a point early in the season where I was like, I missed a couple threes in a row. and I was frustrated, and I'm like coming out of the game, he like subs me out. And you know, I had been conditioned for this to be like a negative thing, like come out, you suck or whatever. And he's laughing, like in the middle of a game, he's laughing at me. I'm like, you can't be laughing at me right now, right? And he's like, he kind of like grabs me. He's like, would you relax? He's like, relax. What are you gonna get a scholarship off of 3 shots? Relax. He's like, go sit down, relax. And he's like, I'm gonna put you back in the game and I'm gonna run a play for you and you're gonna make the 3. And guess what? If you miss it, so what? Right? And I was just kind of like, oh man, this is incredible. Yeah. Right? I was just so conditioned to be playing from someone that was negative, always saying negative things, never being uplifting. And yeah, I got a couple scholarship offers, Division I now. Now I'm getting Division I offers, and I chose Mercer University. And again, I got to play for another amazing guy, Bob Hoffman. And, you know, just somebody who put me in the positions to succeed. And, you know, my senior year in college, I was 2nd in the country in threes made. So I made 107 threes.
Dang.
As a senior in college. So it's one off of the... from Appalachian State, Sims was his first name. Yeah, but it was 1-3.
Number 2 by one shot.
By 1-3. And I remember we played Campbell at home, and I remember there was a shot from the corner that was a 2. I only had 10 twos, so I could remember all those.
It
was a force field. But I had my foot on the line, so I always think about that too, is like, the difference between being able to say you led the country versus not was like a couple centimeters. Man. You know, like the everybody always talks about the game of inches or what. Yeah. But so all of that to say is that because of these decisions that were made, because of the information I was gone, I go from being a guy that had no business as a high school senior playing Division I basketball to a guy who was not good enough to play Division I basketball to a guy that was 2nd in the country on a good team. You know, we lost my senior year, we lost in the conference championship. So it wasn't like we were a bad team. We were a game away from going to the NCAA tournament. And you know, we beat Alabama, we beat Auburn, we took Georgia Tech to the wire. Like I was playing on a good team, producing, and you know, that was all because of, again, a combination of a lot of things, but the right information and processing it correctly.
100%. There's 2 highlights I see in that. Is one, you went to prep school, you weren't didn't duck getting better and staying in high school another year till you started your college clock, and 2, you redshirted a year. I think people also, especially in this day and age where, you know, the COVID thing is ending where everybody had that extra year.
Yeah.
But go to a college where you have an opportunity to redshirt. Like, so you can hit the weight room different. You can go and work out on your own and get that development and improvement that you need along with the team practice. I think people, you know, want to go into high or college and, I was the best player in my league in high school, yet everybody was when you get to college, and maybe even better. Take a year and go get good and use that redshirt year. Learn the system, learn the coach, learn what you're good at.
100%.
Yeah.
And to what you're saying is that, like, nobody asked me how old were you when you were done with college basketball. Nobody asked you all those questions. Like, the things that you feel like are important or are embarrassing in the moment, like, no one remembers that stuff. They just remember the end result. So it's like, I'm 38 now, and no one asked me, like, when I say that I played Division I basketball, when I say that I played professional basketball, no one's like, oh, well, like, how old were you? I was 24 as a senior. I was 23 and 24, which now, again, in college basketball, it's like...
Average.
average. But at the time, like, even my roommates at junior college, one of them just sent a picture in our group chat the other day, and I jokingly was like, I was 26 in this picture. Right? You know, they all had just were like, you know, I was like a couple years older than them. And that was like always the running joke is like, you know, at junior college, I'm turning 22. All my teammates are 18, 19, maybe 20, you know? And so like they used to have all their jokes, but at the end of the day, nobody didn't matter. Cause I would work the system. I'm 4 years removed from high school and I still got 2 years of eligibility left.
Yeah. Man, great work. And so this led you to being a pro. So did you, were you trying to, of course, I know you wanted to go to the NBA. We all did, right? Mm-hmm. So was there a journey for the NBA before you went to play?
No, I mean, I think the closest that I ever got to the NBA was we had a hotel on campus at Mercer, and the cook there was like our guy, right? We'd go over there, we'd eat breakfast. And he was like, man, there's a scout from the New Orleans, I think it was still the New Orleans Hornets at the time. He's like, there's a scout from the New Orleans Hornets that was in here, and, you know, he was talking about you or something like that. And I was like, oh, it's okay. Like, but that's probably like the only thing that I could point to that had anything remotely to do with the NBA. You know, and I wasn't an NBA player, and I always tell people that I thought I was an NBA player, and then we played Florida State my senior year. And the length and athletic, it was like they had a bunch of NBA dudes. And we got, I remember just like, was it Solomon Alibi? You know, I don't want to butcher his name, but I remember like there's a picture of me shooting a corner three and I'm like shooting it off the ceiling, basically. Like, I, you know, it's just like the difference of like getting your shot off, not getting your shot off became very evident to me that day that was like, all right, this is different.
Yeah. Wow. So how did the overseas journey go?
Overseas journey, I signed, my first deal was in the Netherlands, and I started off well. You know, I'm like fifth in the league in scoring. The problem is like I lack self-awareness. I lacked understanding of like how the pro game worked. So I'm going from a Division I program to playing in the Netherlands, playing for the lowest budget, worst team in the Netherlands. Mm. And the Netherlands is like a lower tier league. I'd say some of the teams were at the time probably like mid-tier playing cup, but where we were very much like I should have been grateful for the opportunity that I had. But again, no self-awareness. I was getting paid on time. I was playing 30 minutes a game, shooting it 12 to 15 times a game. I should have been happy. But it was like our coach was not a real coach. They were trying to save money. So this guy was like a truck driver that like also coached basketball, but like he'd come to practice literally like drunk. I remember one time during a game, he was yelling at us to run a press break. And I'm like, we don't have a press break because we never practiced a press break. And he was like, he had given us like a notebook full of like plays and stuff at one point, but we had never practiced any of it, right? So I'm thinking, all right, this is just like a reference to have or whatever. And he was like, it's in the book. I remember being like in the middle of the game being like, what? But like for me, and this is something like I really had to work on and figure out, and unfortunately I had to like learn some hard lessons, was like I was so caught up in that. And then I didn't understand the culture of like the Dutch people, right? So I'm going to the management and being like, yo, and they're like, oh, absolutely, like you're right, like they're listening to me, but they're very non-confrontational. Their culture is very non-confrontational. So like I think that I'm making progress. I think that they hear me. Meanwhile, they're like, yo, we got to get this guy out of here. Like, he's nuts, right? And like, this club ain't serious enough for us to deal with this. You know what I mean? Like, it exists and we're making sure it happens, but like,
wow.
You know, and so I didn't have, like at the time, like looking back on it, like I had an agent and he was a good guy. And when I look back at those emails that I was sending him in the moment, I'm like, I like cringe. Mm. I'm like, dude, what was I saying? What was I doing? I want to tell him, like, shut up, EJ. Like, don't send this email. But again, you know, this is the email that I sent, you know, at this point now 14 years ago, right? So it's probably right around this time a year, November, where like, and I remember the day that I got my release. I got a little bit of money. They paid me like an extra month's salary. And I was going to go to Belgium and I was going to live with my college roommate and his wife and practice with his team. And Belgium was like a step up. And I remember that day going out and sitting, like, you know, Rotterdam has all these kind of like harbors and like ship channels. And I remember sitting on this bench kind of looking out in the water and being like, what did I do? Like, what did I just do? Like, I'm not at practice. The first night that I wasn't at practice. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't have a job. I dreamed my whole life of playing professional basketball. Mm-hmm. And it kind of hit me like, what the heck did I just do? And then, you know, I go to Belgium and I'm practicing, but it's like, they were never gonna sign me. This team was never gonna pick me up. So then, now what? I'm going home at Christmas time. I got no job. what am I going to do? My college coach says, hey, listen, if you can't get a team, you can come back to Mercer. You can do, I'll pay for your grad classes and just be around the team. He's like, basically be a grad assistant without any responsibilities. He's like, just come to practice, be around, work out, use the facility, but like, you don't have to do anything. So I did that for a semester, but then like there's that, you're back on campus and people are like, what are you doing here? I thought you were playing pro ball. And I was like, oh, well, I was until I got cut and then I couldn't get another team.
Wow.
So it was very humbling. And so then,
What do you think, because you said looking back on it, like you cringe at your attitude then.
Mm-hmm.
What got you to where your attitude was like that, where it's a little, crisis, right?
Yeah, I think it was just not being realistic with myself, like not understanding the journey, not understanding like you got to go through some stuff. Like when you talk to somebody and they say they've played X amount of years overseas, like it tells me something about them immediately. Like, dang, you got some grit, because it's not like I didn't have hot water in my shower upstairs. We didn't have a washing machine for the first month I was there. So it's like these little things that you think are big inconveniences, but like the appreciation of having a job, playing a silly game where you put a ball through a hoop for a living, like that you played for free your whole life, has to outweigh those things, right? And I'm not saying that like players should just be willing to take abuse just because they have the opportunity to play professional basketball, but like there's got to be a level of self-awareness. Like I always say, like, you know, player, agent, and reality have to be in alignment. Like if one of those things is out of line, then like something's got, like the relationship between the player and agent won't work, the team, like it just won't work. And so I didn't have a healthy understanding of reality. Like, okay, that's what I got to go through. I got to prove myself. And then, you know, when I have leverage or if I get to a certain level, then you can start saying things about this stuff. But I had no leverage in the situation. We weren't winning games. I was scoring points, but they were like, sure, we can flip you out with somebody else and still continue to lose game. Like,
man, all right, so you come back home.
Mm-hmm.
You realize that you need to go back overseas quick. So what happens next?
I mean, the next year I went through, I ended up playing in the NBL Canada, which was like in its inaugural season. So I went to like this tryout camp. And then from there, got invited to like one of the team's training camp, Oshawa Power. And then I had to make the team. We probably had like 50 players come through for 10 spots. And so it was one of those things. It was like I told people it was like the Royal Rumble. So like you'd have five guys get cut and you'd be like, all right, there's five more guys. Like I survived this round of cuts. But the problem was like the next day there were five more guys showing up with like their suitcases packed for a whole season, like thought they were already on the team. And they'd show up and be like, why is there like 40 dudes here? It's like, yeah, bro. Like
they
didn't
try out, or they're like, oh, you're
okay. I don't know what some agents or people told some of these guys. I knew what it was. I knew it was training camp, but I thought it was gonna be like, all right, 10 spots, they bringing in like 20 guys.
Right.
And it was like, nah, they brought in as many players. Like it was literally nuts. And so like, you know, I had prepared for it. Like Pete Strobel, who I mentioned before, trainer-wise, like he had really got me ready. Like no friends, like make yourself stand out. We had this thing called rumble seats because he was like, would you rather go to a movie theater and sit there and watch it in black and white with no sound? Or would you rather go in and it's like surround sound, color, seats are rumbling every time something happens. He's like, so you got to be loud and you got to make yourself really stand out. And so like, I mean, there were some moments where like a lot of people in that gym hated me, but I was like, I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to make this team. And like, I mean, I got punched me during you know, like scrimmaging, in training camp. Yeah. Like I'm just trying to think of like the guys like that were in camp. I'm trying to even think of some like West Coast guys. Omari Johnson.
Yeah.
You know, it was crazy. So he was on my team. Yeah. Him.
I could be getting punched in a game.
Well, it was like in training. It's like training camp, so he's scrimmaging. It's not like in a game.
I mean, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, but I know. But no, but I mean, it was like, I mean, I was like talking.
Right.
Well, I was reckless. I mean, I was trying to make that team and stand out.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I was like, I'm going to make this team, and I'm going to make sure that I do everything I can. I was in the best shape of my life. And it was all just to make this team, you know, to be on this roster of 10. the conditions were like way worse than like what I had in the Netherlands. Like we were in a townhouse, I was sleeping on a mattress. I always joke with people. I'm always like, you know, I knew my wife really loved me when we shared a room. We shared a room with a teammate. So like me and my wife were sleeping on a mattress on the floor with a, like sharing this room with a teammate. So we had like a bathroom, like it was wild.
Was it a discussion when that happened? I was like, no, this is what we're doing because we're a pro. Or like, or
I mean, like, I think she really like again, like wives are often like the voice of reason, right? Like, and I remember even when I was like leaving the Netherlands, she was like, what are you doing? What? And I was like, so caught up in the emotion of, well, this and that. She's just like, okay, like, sounds crazy. It seems crazy. Like, you worked your whole life for this and now you're just leaving. And then even in that, she, at a certain point, she was like, because the team implemented a rule where you couldn't have a girl stay with you overnight for more than 2 out of 3 nights. And so I was like, all right, this doesn't apply to me because, like, I'm married. Like, this isn't just, like, some random person, like, staying at the house. This is my wife. They're like, no, it applies to you. So every third night, like we're going and staying at like a hotel. And so at a certain point, she was like, look, I'm driving back to Pittsburgh. I'm gonna stay with your parents. Mm. And like, we'll just see how this like plays out, because they kept saying they were gonna get proper housing and all these different things, but it's Upstart League, new organization. You know, you're trying to piece things together and figure it out. And then I ended up eventually getting waived because they made a trade. Like you see the trade happen, you're like, all right, they're bringing two players in, but they're only sending one out. That means somebody's gone. And I remember our coach, we pulled into the driveway.
Wait, so you made the 10-man?
I made the 10-man roster. I made the 10-man roster, so I made it for like the first probably like 11 or so games of the season. So I made it, you know. And then after that, I remember we pulled in, we had moved to, this guy had like opened his home to like four of us. And so I was like living in this guy's basement. And he had like a family and everything, like kids. So like he was like, he had two kids. It was.
This is the craziest.
It's wild. Yeah, it's wild. And so, I remember we pulled in the driveway and it was like, everybody were like getting out of like the minivan and my coach was just like, oh, hey, by the way, like you're cut kind of thing. And I was like, I'm like halfway out, like the door, like I'm cut, like, cut.
No.
And so like, man, I remember being like, you know, crushed, because like, man, you put so much into it, and then it's just like, oh man, I'm back to like square one. And I remember just like going in the house, and I just started sending emails, like right back to like trying to get myself a job. And at this point, I didn't have an agent. You know what I mean? I was like doing this on my own, because at that point, number one, I didn't have a ton of agents that were like looking to necessarily sign me. There was a ton of value there. And the agent that I had been working with, we just gone separate ways. And not necessarily like, I think there was a narrative that I definitely had in my head about that. And like looking back on it and now being an agent and rereading emails, I have a totally different perspective on it too. I'm like, he wasn't bad. You know, like, I was definitely more in the wrong than he was.
Wow. Man, you learned a lot through your trial and error. Just your journey. So you become your own agent. That kind of appreciates who you are now.
Yeah.
It seemed like you already had the information that you needed a lot, right? And then the work ethic, like you knew how to get back up and keep pushing.
I
that in your story over and over.
Over and over, yeah.
You talked about it, your parents kind of giving you that base. Is there any other element that like, you know, that engraved that in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that idea of like, if I don't do it now, I can never come back and do it again, right? And like, am I okay walking away? And then also like when you're married, right? That's a different conversation. I always tell people, professional basketball is a single man's game unless, right? Like you have a very supportive, you know, partner, spouse, girlfriend, right? And my wife was so great about, this was here before me. Right, like you wanted to be a professional, but she's like, I know that there's like, this is gonna end at some point. Like you can't do this forever. So like I'm willing within reason to just see it through for as long as like makes sense. But you know, that was like a lot on her too, because like we're living, because you can't like get a place, because I might get a job the next day. It might be a month, 2 months. So we're staying at like her mom's house. So we're staying with like my mother-in-law, And, you know, she's in her hometown too. So here she is married. Her husband's a professional basketball player, but you're living with your mom, right? Like, you know, and I was waiting tables. I was a waiter. I got a job waiting tables after I got released. And she's working at Starbucks just to try and figure it out, make it work. And right when it was like time where like I had given her like a cutoff, I was like, if I don't have a job by, I think it was like September 1 or like October 1 or something like that, because we had gone that whole back end of the season again without a job. And she said, I got this offer in Australia. But like the season didn't start until, it was the CBL, which is now the NBL 1. It didn't start, the season didn't start until like February or March. So the team wasn't gonna bring me over to January. So it was almost like one of those things where she was like, oh, you got an offer and it's not for like 4 months, right? So I was like that, you know, and then I did that incredible experience in Australia. And then through that process, I had been working on years on getting my Hungarian passport because my grandmother was Hungarian. So like her parents, my great grandparents had come over from Hungary. So I was able to connect all of that with paperwork and documentation. Wow. And so a team in Hungary came and signed me for my fourth year under the kind of provision that if the passport went through, I had a contract. If it didn't, then they could let me go. And so I got that Hungarian passport. And so then I played my last two seasons in Hungary, but mostly because, again, I was thinking outside of the box. I was resourceful. I put all this paperwork together. And then there was a team in Hungary that, you know, saw the value in it. And there was an agent too. I did a video on my Instagram about that story too. You know, it was kind of like a blessing and a curse because he opened the door for that opportunity to happen. But then he was on the team side. So when like stuff got difficult, I was again back to like advocating for myself. Yeah. Right, I'm negotiating certain deals, and team didn't want to fly over my wife, and they wanted to cut my pay, and so, you know, it was this, yeah. If people want to, I did a 3-part series on my Instagram, kind of like breaking that down. If people, you know, want to hear that story, and then yeah, my last year, was playing for a coach that liked me. Put me in a great position. I thought this is gonna be the thing that propels my career. I developed like really bad plantar fasciitis. They were giving me shots. They were giving me like, I got like 3 cortisone shots in like a 6-week period, which I had no idea is like, you don't, that's like insane.
OD. Yeah.
Yeah, and they fired him. New coach comes in, Slovenian guy that's just like, you know, had some very choice words for me from the beginning. I'm like, I don't even know you, but like, you're really questioning like my, who I am as a person, is taking everything in me. And so then I am back to the table negotiating again with the team on like where to go, release. And at the time we had I have 4 kids. We had my daughter Ava, and so she had been born. Not 4 kids through all this. We had 1 at the time.
Oh.
No. So my first of four, like, so at the time she was born in May. So this is all happening that season. So she was with us in Hungary, and
she was born in Hungary?
No, she was born in America. She was born in May. So like I actually got to come home early. Like I missed the playoffs of my Hungarian year. I got negotiated a release so I could go home, thinking that she was like, the doctor was like, they could come any day. And I remember flew home like May 2nd and thinking like, all right, the baby's gonna come. And then she came May 28th. So like I could have stayed, but you know, like you just can't predict these things.
Yeah.
But again, it was like, now we have, okay, I'm married and we have a daughter. And I remember I had this opportunity to go to Spain. It was a 2-month deal after the Hungary thing. And my wife was like, look, you go do this. I feel like you have to do this. Like maybe it helps bring some kind of closure. I think she was probably thinking like, please go do this and it'll be over. So she went home with my daughter. And I just remember being in Spain. It was like the lowest level that I had ever played at. I wasn't beginning making really any money other than the money that the Hungarian team had to pay me to cut me. And probably like the first week I was there, I was like, I'm done. But you know, I finished out that stint. I come home and I'm so grateful for my wife that like, she set boundaries and had those conversations and drew lines, but ultimately she allowed me to come to the conclusion like it's over. And I know sometimes, like, as players, like, I've seen players that can't come to that conclusion, and it really hurts their marriage or relationship, like, to the point where, like, it doesn't exist anymore. But I do really appreciate that she did that. And then to pay her back, I was, like, home for, like, a month. I remember coming in from being outside on the phone and being like, I figured out what I'm going to do. And she's like, great, what is it? 9 to 5, it's going to be solid. You know, it's going to be like stress-free. We're going to have something just consistent. We already went through all this craziness. And I was like, I'm going to be an agent, you know? And she's like, what? You know what I mean? And I was like, well, you know, this is it. I don't really like agents. I don't really want to, you know, maybe I don't want to do it or whatever. And she was like, look, she's like, honestly, she's like, I could sit here and talk you out of being an agent. She's like, but you should be an agent. And all the reasons you don't want to be an agent are the reasons you should be an agent. It's like, you have the empathy, you've been through it, you understand it. She's like, and you're like nuts about like the emails and the different things that you would do and connecting dots and all this stuff. She's like, so like, you should do it. And then she was like, kind of like, let's see how it goes too. She's like, but at the same time, like, this ain't paying the bills right now, because the deal that I got was like a percentage. I was getting a percentage of anything that came in that I brought in, but I had like no expenses, no healthcare, no.
You're just working off a referral commission, essentially.
I mean, essentially, yeah. And I wasn't certified, so yeah. So, and so I got a job teaching. So I was teaching PE, and then I went back to waiting tables. So, you know, I had those like basically kind of three jobs going. So I remember I'd be on phones with players and be like, yeah, like I gotta run, you know. And it was either because like I might have 20 third graders ready to barrel through the door for PE class, or I gotta just had a five top sat, you know, at the restaurant. I gotta go take their order.
Wow.
Yeah.
Your ambition and your ability to not create excuses stands out, man. Like, that's, I hope the kids hear it so they can stop making excuses for basketball. But even the parents like, hear it to understand what it takes to just be a pro, to just be a part of this game long term. It's a lot of sacrifice and a lot of understanding. And you highlighted your wife and all the amazing grace that she gave you.
Yeah.
Is she enjoying you being an agent now? Like, she.
Yeah, I think now, I mean, it's just, it's evolved, right? So, like, now it's like I've, you know, now at this place where, like, you know, I'm fortunate to be able to represent NBA players, got high guys playing high level overseas, and it's kind of just like everything that I could have dreamed of. Like, I think sometimes you lose sight of where you were and where you are now. And so, like, I always like to, like, reflect back and be like, all right, what would, like, EJ 5-10 years ago, like, what would he think if I told him this is what we were doing? Mm-hmm. And so you have to find that balance of like being proud but not being comfortable, right? And I think there's a lot that goes into it, a lot of a roller coaster, and I think that it's been worth it, right? Like, I can support my family doing it. And so I think that's where she's like, okay, he's doing what he loves. It creates a lot of cool opportunities. Now that we have kids, you know, there's downsides to it too. It's like, you know, I lost a client, you know, within the last year. And like, yes, every agent gets fired, right? That's something that everybody wants to highlight. It happens, but like seeing my kids go and like take down pictures with that player was like, this was like a first of like, this was like understanding that they're on this journey now too. And it's like deeply personal to them now too, where it's like, man, there's this person that's been in our life for this long and now they're not. And we have, you know, pictures and kind of different things like all over our room.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
So, yeah, but at the end of the day, it's like, I tell people all the time, it's like, if I was doing something else, I'd be telling people about the job that I used to do, and they'd be like, why are you here, right? Like, tonight I'm in town, we're doing a podcast, I'm going to an NBA game tonight to see a client. Like, it's pretty awesome, you know what I mean? That's exciting, that's great. I mean, to me, it's like, there's nothing better. So I think as an agent too, because I think agents can get kind of bogged down in the negative side of the business, is like focusing more on the positive side of it is like, this is a huge blessing. Like, you get to be on these journeys with these guys. And I think it's recognizing, we talked about this a little bit before the show, is just like, it's a player's game. Yeah. So it's like the players ultimately dictate this. And so you have to understand that coming into it.
When did you officially get certified as an agent? And who was your first NBA client?
So 2017, I got certified. So I started March 1st, 2015 was like my first day as an agent. I got certified in, this was like January of 2017, NBA certified and FIBA certified. And first NBA client was Ben Moore. Ben Moore, he played at SMU. He played with the, signed with the Indiana Pacers. So he had an Exhibit 10 and then ended up getting a two-way that season. It was like the first, I think it was the first year, two-way contracts. And then the following year, he actually got a roster spot. He had a 15-man roster spot for part of the season with the Pacers. And yeah, I mean, it was, he still is still a client, and he's such a big part of my journey because, like, he trusted something that was quote unquote unproven.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, so, like, all players, like, most players that I recruit, I think they're NBA players. And, like, I'm okay with that. I think some people are like, man, come on, this guy's not realistic. And it's like, I honestly want guys to believe that they can play at the highest level. Like, if they don't, then I don't know that I would want to represent them. I mean, yeah, there is a balance to some of this stuff, but he's just a great human being. And it also just helped. Like, I always tell people, like, Josh Bostic really helped, was like my first, like, I say, like, big client. Like, he was a Euro Cup level guy overseas, where he showed me that, like, because when you become an agent, you don't have any players. It's like, that's scary to people. You're like, yeah, I'm an agent. Like, who do you represent? No one. What? Okay, I'm not signing with you. But I think Josh and then Bennett showed me too is like the type of people that I wanted to work with. You know, Ben, hard worker, just a super unselfish player, person. And one great story that I'll tell about Ben is I remember we did his pro day. And it was just like him in this like little side gym in Chicago. We did our pro day across the street from another agency's pro day, but we did it 1 hour before. They were so pissed, but like,
why are they pissed?
It was great. It was fun. It was just like a strategic thing. You got to think outside of the box. Like, all these NBA people are for sure going there. So we did it an hour before. And so we told people, it's like right across the street. You can come. And they're already in town. Right. Why wouldn't they? Yeah, we'll come. We can come see Ben. So we had all these guys in this little community gym in Chicago. And I remember we left and we walked outside and there's probably like, I don't know, 8 to 10 like homeless people, like between the where we were and the big gym, which is, what's the one in Chicago that
Attack,
right? Or whatever it's called now, right? And we got in the car and he was like, hey, where did all those Gatorade, what did we do with the drinks and the snacks and all the stuff that we had for the scouts? And we were like, man, I don't know. I think we just left them in the office in there. He was like, no, we got to go back in. We got to go back in. Look at, there's all these people here that could use that. And so we get out of the car, we go back in, we get the snacks and the Gatorades and the waters. And we're back out on the street, passing it out to the people. And so, for somebody like him who was, you know, probably what, 20, I don't know, 2 years old at the time, to just see that, to just see people. And that day to him was like, could have been all about him. The focus was on him, NBA. He could have been thinking about that, but like, that's who he is. And like, to me, it was like, man, these are the people that I want to work with. This is so much more enjoyable to go through this journey with somebody like him. And, you know, like I'm a Steelers fan, you know, and Mike Tomlin says the standard is the standard. And I give credit to guys like Josh Bostic and Ben Moore for like setting that standard of like, this is who I want to work with and this is who I want to, you know, represent.
That's awesome. So how do you target and find people that are like that? Like, what do you recruit, right? Like, what are the things that you see that are,
I mean, I think it's like, number one, it is talent-based industry. So you are looking for, and a lot of that is like, I think, because you play doesn't mean that you're going to be a good evaluator, or be a good agent, or be a good coach. But I think that there's certain things that I've been able to see in guys that maybe are like being missed. And so, like, first you're looking at that, you're looking at the talent piece of it. And then the next thing you're like, all right, is there a connection piece there? Is there a borrowed trust? Is there somebody that knows that person that could make the introduction? And then the next part is like, ask questions. Like, I think I don't go into any meeting assuming that that player is the right player for me to represent. And I think a lot of agents come in the room and are like, assume, like, almost want to force it if it's, even if it's not a fit, because they have to, like, I have to sign this player. For me, it's like, is this going to work? Because I'd rather identify it's going to work now than, like, find out down the road that it's not going to work. And I learned that through my first, like, two years being an agent, is like, I was just signing players just so I could say that I signed players, and then realize, like, this is not a good fit. Like, this is not, you know, what I want to be doing or what my life to be like. So I think that's the biggest part, is like asking questions, getting to know them. What are their goals? How can I help you get to those goals? Are those goals realistic or not? And then if that is your goal, like, are you open to different pathways? You know, like, here's what that could look like. And I think, like, through that you get a feel for, like, all right, this is the right person. And then you hope that they feel the same way.
Right. Yeah. That's awesome. It's showing the different way of how to be an agent, right? Like, where it's a numbers game. There's only, especially on the NBA side, it's 450 players that are going to get that contract and be on the team, right? And then, you know, you have your two-way guys, G League guys and all that, and then you have the overseas. But, like, to find the fit for you as an agent, and then you know that you can service that person at a very high level just because of who they are, who... You know, because you know who you wanted. So it's cool to see that, you know, I'm around bigger agencies, and a lot of them have that personal touch for sure. But you can also see, like, hey, man, they're trying to get the numbers. They're trying to get as many agencies as possible.
So some of it becomes, like, from a competitive standpoint, is, like, trying to have as many pieces on the board as possible versus, like, the – individual, is this what's best for each individual player? And like I said, so time was like, each player is different and unique, like, wants something, needs something different. Like, my only goal in everything is to make sure that players know how to hold their representation accountable so that they are getting the best from who's ever representing them. And if they're not getting the best from who's representing them, that they're able to identify that. Because that's kind of the problem in the industry that I see, is that players don't know when they're getting poor representation. They sometimes don't know when they're getting good representation, right? There could be a narrative of, like, your agent's not doing a good job, and they could be doing an amazing job. And I've had conversations with players where they're, like, thinking about switching agents, and I'm like, well, why? What's wrong? And they're like, well, this, and this. And I'm like, no, that's not. I was like, your agent's doing a good job. Like, my job here is not to, like, continue to dig in there, because if you switch and you're working with me now, like, I'm inheriting those same problems. Like, if my job, if I really want to, and it's hard to, like, not be like, ooh, this is an opportunity to maybe get this guy, but it's like, no, man, if your agent's doing a good job, like, ultimately you should stay with him. Right. If he's not, or if there's some things we can identify. And also, too, like, have you given him an opportunity to fix it? So, like, if you've identified this as a problem, does he know it's a problem?
Right.
Right? And if you've told him, hey, this is a problem, and he hasn't fixed it, okay, then, yeah, you should be probably looking for new representation. But if, like, you haven't given him the opportunity or had this kind of candid conversation, you should do that too.
And that happens a lot in youth sports, especially high school basketball. because the years, like, when you have a conflict, man, I go with the Bible says, you go to that person first, and let them know that there's a conflict. And if you can't resolve it, then bring in another party and, you know, so forth. But I think that happens is, like, man, coach doesn't like me. Parent hears that.
Yeah.
Look at what's happening in the game without knowing what's happening at practice. What's your kid's attitude like? Why aren't they getting playing time? Mm-hmm. Why are they feel like they're being treated a certain way without having that conversation before you start to go tell other parents, talk to other high school coaches, all these other things. You start doing the stuff that isn't necessary.
Yes.
Have a conversation.
Yep.
Where are we? Where do we stand? And hopefully the coach is being forthright. I think there's some on that side too, where the coach is holding on and trying to still be a salesman for somebody who's already with them. But if the parents and the kids would just be hey, very direct, like, where do you see me in this program? And asking the right questions. And we do a lot of that. Like, I tell parents what to ask when they go and visit school. I tell them, you know, look for when you're in an AAU program and you're, you know, that's where you want to go play. Like, here's what you ask, this is what you look for. And like you said, just knowing that stuff is super important. But it's crazy to see it's at the next level as well, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's at every level. I mean, that's, I mean, we talked about this before, like, that's why, like, I've begun to use my Instagram as an educational tool, is because I want players to know this stuff. Like, my goal in this is, like you said, there's 450, like, roster, say, non-two-way spots in the NBA. You can't represent all those players, right? There's only so many players that you can represent and represent well, right? There's a threshold for every agent, and it's going to be different for each agent depending on how hands-on they are. But you've got to be able to know, is identify if your agent doing a good job. And I think a lot of players, it's kind of like, afraid is not the word, but like, they feel like they can't ask those questions. But it's like, no, it should be a partnership. Like, the agent does work for you. Like, I've heard that all the time. The agent works for you, remember that. And that's true. But to me, it's like, it's a step further. It should be a partnership. It should be working together. And I want players to be able to identify, like, is this an actual partnership? Is there, like, actual accountability? Because people throw trust around all the time. Like, oh, you can trust me. Or, like, that accountability breeds trust. So when you have a system in place where, like, you're able to hold each other accountable, that goes both ways. Like, agents should be able to hold players accountable, players should be able to hold agents accountable. And then when you have that, when you can have that open and real dialogue, it's when you're ultimately going to get the best result.
100%. And you mentioned your Instagram. It's a educational force, man. If you want to learn about the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement for the NBA, and what the rules are and what certain things mean and trades, and I'm sure it's going to be real cool around the trade deadline, like, just certain things that can happen, and the information you're sharing, you make it very clear, and it's very, you know, this is stuff you can Google. But for you to share it in your position as already being an agent, you know, making sure that the players know, and that's all it's about, is sharing information. And so thank you for that. When I first saw it, like, I saw it before I actually met you. I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. Like, I think I know some of this stuff, but it's cool, like, the updates and the new CBA and all that kind of stuff as time goes on. And then being connected with Jordan is the first one that connected us, right?
Jordan Wild.
Shay's here last week telling me, you know, oh, that's my best friend. Like, wait, what? A lot of people, so... That platform and what you're doing on social media, you know, where do you see the growth going with you sharing that information?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, I've had so many people hit me with, like, you should do this or you should do this now. I mean, I think, like, my focus right now is just being able to continue to kind of add to the catalog of stuff that I've done. Like, I mean, when I was flying out here, right, I was kind of just, like, writing out what my next videos are going to be on, trying to make them more connected to, like, recent events or things that are happening, explain, but, like, also not, like, kind of cross that line where I'm talking about another agent's work or a team, like, having some kind of opinion, but just more so being, like, wanting people to, like, think and understand why these things are happening. So when you see it, you're like, oh, I can either go watch this video or I know, oh, I understand that. And especially with the new CBA, is like, things have changed. Like, it's a whole new system and teams are operating differently. Players should be operating differently too. And I think that players have this certain mindset. They see one thing happen, but if you don't know how it happened, then, you know, you're kind of missing the boat. And you could be putting yourself at a disadvantage, right? Or if you're not finding out if your agent is doing the right things. I mean, I had this one video where, like, I literally was talking to a player and he didn't know that he had early bird rights. And so I literally said, call your agent. You have early bird rights. Like, this is a key part of, like, you negotiating in 30 days when free agency is. And he called me back, and I remember him being, like, almost very confident and, like, nah, I talked to him. I don't. And I'm like, no, what I'm saying is, like, this isn't me. Like, I'm not one to bash. I'm not bashing agents. I'm not, like, I was like, like it's you do like it's a fundamental it's not an opinion like this is an actual fact. And to me that was like blew my mind, because this wasn't an agent that just was like, this guy had been representing or working at a company or like representing NBA players for like way longer than me. Right, so like I would run up against that kind of stuff all the time where they're like, well, he's been doing it for this long. And I'm like, if he doesn't know this, this is like the core fundamental piece of like your negotiation. So he's negotiating off of like the wrong thing here. And like, you should hold him accountable to that. And you should know enough to be able to know that he's wrong. And you should call the Players Association also, because there's this resource you have that players don't use enough of to be able to corroborate things too. And I think just trusting an agent, and I tell my players this all the time, like, don't just trust me. I was just doing a contract with a guy the other day. Read this contract, ask all the questions. Let's get through this, work through this together. Like, don't be afraid to ask anything about this, because this is your life at the end of the day. You know, I can be an agent for as long as I want, really. But like, as a player, you can only be a player for a certain period of time. So make sure you ask those questions.
No, and I love that. And it's, I hope agents don't feel threatened by you, right? Like, all you're doing is educating them on what they should have be educating their clients on anyway. Like, that's
Because
if you're doing your job,
yeah,
someone like you is a resource, not really a threat, right? It's like just confirming what your agent is already telling you as well. So where you're giving that information to someone and they don't know they have their early bird rights, which is crazy. Like, you should know that. Like, step your game up.
I mean, I'll take it a step forward, and I won't like out anybody here, but I had a player last year in a team that both were running, or said that, like, the player said their agency was running an all defensive campaign for them, because, you know, and then I saw a team running a campaign for, happened to also be all defensive team for a player, and both players were ineligible for the award because they have the 65 game rule, right? Which they put in place to kind of deter load management.
Right.
But the way the intricacies of it like ended up hurting like some of these like rotational like back end starter guys that could have been qualifying for these like, you know, all defensive teams or guys that maybe weren't playing as many minutes, because it's 65 games, but they give you a little bit of wiggle room where, like, you know, you can have a couple games where you play between 15 and 20, but that's it. But like, you had a lot of these guys that had played maybe early in the season, had played 15, 17, 19, 18 minutes a game, that like weren't gonna have enough games to be eligible. And so I saw that and I'm like, this team doesn't know this. And this player who is with, you know, this name agency. And so then when I told the player, I was like, bro, you're not even eligible. He was like, oh yeah, well, they're not doing a campaign. And I'm like, wait, they either are doing a campaign or they're not doing a campaign. And if they were doing a campaign, they didn't know this. And now they're not, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it's like, again, that's where I get some of this, where the player was just like so willing to just want to defend the
agent.
Yeah, who they already committed. But they've already committed that too. It's like when you know.
Why are they calling you then, if that's real trust?
Well, I mean, but that's also like, that's also me having certain relationships and like having, you know, I'm wanting to help guys at the end of the day. Like, that's why I got into this business. Like, I didn't know that I was gonna end up representing NBA guys. Like, I started off representing overseas guys, and I was just, I'm gonna help guys that are like me. And then it became one of those things where it's like, all right, I've gotta find a balance of like, how can I help guys, but also like make a living? Because if I'm just looking for guys like me, I'm gonna have to represent 100 players,
right?
I started doing the numbers and understanding like, who do I wanna be? And I was like, all right, I wanna be in a place where, you know, I can put a lot of energy into, you know, a small group of players, but I also don't want to forget all the people that helped me, important to me, and gave me good information throughout my pro career. Like, I still want to be able to do that. Like, I still want to find ways to connect with players and give them good advice and kind of give them the blueprint of like how I rep myself.
Yeah.
So,
man, thank you for just sharing that, your journey, man, and what you do. Keep doing it. It's amazing how you just endured, you know, through your pro career, and the decisions you made and sticking to it, and just deciding one day that you're going to be an agent right after you retire and making it work, you know, like, like the perseverance is everything, and staying connected to this game is so important to us players, you know, like, we all have that hoop dream of being in the NBA, and you're in the NBA in a sort of way, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. We want to move on to our next segment. It's my Rushmore, okay? So your top four teammates of all time.
Yeah, and you gave me some time to think about this.
Yes.
And I'm just thinking about, it's one of those questions where, like, I'm going to give you four names. I'm for sure going to hear from somebody and be like, yeah, you're right, you're right.
Guys.
I still do.
Don't worry about it.
And it's the hard part, I think, is because I've been, you know, been at so many different places. So I almost want to just, like, think of, like, the relationships. Like, Travis Hill has got to be one of them. That's at Centenary.
Yeah.
He started off at Centenary as our manager and worked his way to being not just, like, being on the team, but, like, ended up, like, playing, like, real Division I games.
Nice.
So it's like, I was like a story, like, it's like another story, like, of a guy, like, I love to use is, like, to think if he would, he, like, all in his mind thought, like, he could play Division I basketball, and I guarantee you there wasn't one person that thought that that was going to happen other than him, and he made it happen.
Love that.
And so, like, that's why I always say, never knock somebody for their belief, as long as, like, the work and the stuff follows that. Like, if you say, hey, I'm going to do this, but you don't work hard, no, we forget that. But if you say, I'm going to do this, and you have the work ethic to match it, it's definitely him. Then I got to say probably Danny Emerson, my roommate, teammate at Mercer. Spent a lot of time in the gym. With him. Probably my man Jarko Rokocevic. He was my teammate in Hungary.
Okay.
He's originally from Montenegro. It's another cool thing. I think it's just like these relationships you build with people that grew up completely different than you, speak a different language. But we loved drinking coffee. So, you know, that was our bond every day. It's like we're going and getting coffee. So he had cigarettes, too. I skipped that part.
I don't understand how you smoke cigarettes.
I don't know, man. Hey, but there's something. Hey.
NBA All-Star. We were in Vegas, and my homeboy, dude, in the restroom, right? And this NBA All-Star was just smoking cigarettes, like, in his prime.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, and so my friend, this is Vegas, right? My friend's a little tipsy. And he's like, man, you know you shouldn't be smoking cigarettes. This is why they're, like, using the restroom in the stall next to him. Like, man, you know you shouldn't be smoking cigarettes. And he, like, dude looks at him, and he's like, you're an NBA All-Star smoking cigarettes? Dog, get out of here. Like, I don't get that. I don't understand it.
But I don't know. I mean, he was our best player.
That guy was an All-Star. The next year, he pretty much...
Yeah, I don't know. My guy Jarko was he was like, I mean, he probably averaged like 19, 11, two blocks. I mean, he was unreal. He was so good. Like, but I just never, you know, I was like, I don't know how he does it. It was like amazing to me. Like, I was like, man, the human body is incredible that he could come and go and do what he did. And then, the fourth one. I'm trying to hit like every level here. Probably my guy Scott Thomas, just because he was like my best friend in high school, teammates, and we just caught an NBA game recently. So I guess that's fresh on my mind. That'd have to be my four, and I know I forgot somebody. I'll get this clip and tag the people that I forgot.
There you go. All love. For me, man, my top four, and it's easy because my jerseys are out there, like, just kind of go through. Man, I had one of them is two people. My first team, it was Nick G and Nick Dub. Nick G was our point guard, Nick Woodard was our center, and, like, they just took me in. Like, this is my first year playing basketball ever. I was 11 years old. and I learned to play street ball first, and but like more organized, and their dads were my club team coaches for those Tar Heels teams. But like,
yeah,
it just became, you know, instant friends. Like we all made the all-star team for that league, played together pretty much our whole lives. And so, you know, just some lifetime basketball homies.
Yeah.
They're one in the same just because they came at the same time. And then, man, I'm trying to think. It's probably them through that whole time. And then in high school, my boy Jonathan Montoya, we were like the same kind of player, same kind of kids. Like we worked hard, but we had no direction.
Mm-hmm.
And like just the stuff that we went through, going through all that. And it's crazy. I think I went further than most of my friends in high school playing basketball when I was not as good as them, for sure. Like that late bloomer thing that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's cool to see. And at Dodge City, my boy DeMarcus Lade, he ended up playing at UTSA, but like when we were at Dodge City at community college, we would just be in the gym all day, shooting, working on stuff. And so just that person you grind with and in the gym with.
Yeah.
You always remember those people who like put in the work.
Put in the work, yeah.
Last one, man. You know, it's my adult league buddy, Josh Merrill. we don't lose much.
Yeah.
6'9", played at UCSB, played overseas in Australia. He's a sports pastor over at Shepherd Church out here. And man, he can shoot it. He's 6'9", he can shoot it. He gets on my nerves on defense. He's good because he's tall and he's adult league, but he doesn't really play defense. But man, I have a lot of fun playing with him just because we play off each other very well, so. It's always good to have a good teammate, man. Basketball.
Absolutely. I gotta give like an honorary top four guy that just came to my mind. Did like, you know, I'm not saying who I would have taken out of my top four, but Torrey Stapleton.
Okay.
My man Torrey Stapleton. So we played on that Jersey Cyclones team together. And Torrey actually lives out here now, and just a great dude. Just like one of those guys that's just like the ultimate teammate, and then also just like that's who he is as like a person now too. Like he just did a huge community thing. He does, was it Between the Lines? It's like going into prisons and like using basketball as a way to like.
I've never heard his name before.
Yeah, yeah. So he's the man. So like as we're talking about this, it's like I knew there was gonna be somebody, and it was definitely Torrey.
We'll take honorable mention. We usually don't like them here. We want the
defense. I know.
Next is fix the net. Okay, a misconception about EJ that you want to be clear. Here's the ball. Your misconception, and then not yet.
I gotta say it.
Yep.
Misconception about me is that you don't need one of these name agencies. I can get it done, and I have to get it done. If you want to give me the opportunity, I'll tell you why I can get it done and how I got it done. So I think that's the biggest thing.
I love it.
Yeah. Just drop it through?
Yeah, dunk, whatever you want to do.
All right, man. Shoot it. I'm a shooter, man. You know? I don't want to go, you know, go against the grain there too much.
And then flip the script. So two questions for me could be about anything you want.
Yeah, what would you what would you say to, I don't know, say your high school self, like about, like, what would you do, not necessarily what would you do differently, but what advice would you give that you wish you had then, I guess? Mm-hmm. And then second question would be,
let me answer that one because I'll come with the second one.
Yeah.
Okay. To my high school self, man, work hard with intention.
Mm-hmm.
I would work hard and not know why I was working hard. And so, like, truly understand what's being taught to you and what's being shown, and take advantage. Like, I had some really good coaches and trainers around me. You know, my friends who went Division I, like right out of high school and all that, they used to invite me to the workouts and I didn't go. I'll go work out by myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just not knowing what was happening. Like, hey, we're gonna go run hills. And you run hills for like 5'7" dunking. But being in better shape and being around that level of talent, like understanding my environment and where I was and You know, I'm going to UCLA. I want to go to UCLA. You don't even have Fullerton Junior College calling you.
About
like not just truly not understanding the landscape. So just being aware of my environment.
Okay. Second question is what does it feel like when you see a player that you've worked with or a family you've worked with, like you see like the plan come together and them succeed? And they give, you know, and then and you're kind of like part of that success story.
Feels amazing. I probably kind of felt it, you know, kids signing day, you know, kids that I've been working with, well, multiple kids, but two kids specifically that I've been working with literally probably every day for their last 4 years, or a lot, I'm gonna say every day, but we're in the gym a lot. And so they both signed, one signed to San Diego State, one signed to St. Mary's. And it's amazing, like I'm proud of them, but my mind works is like, okay, now I gotta get you ready for college. Like, we got 8 months until you're on college campus and both of you guys wanna be in the NBA, so how do we, what's next? I'm always like, how do I get you to that next step? And a lot of times, we talked about this earlier, I think before the cameras came on, is like, what you are known for is what people will ask you advice on.
I'm known
as a middle school coach, trainer. But I'm so much more. More connections. I have so many more solutions and resources for anybody to get them to the level. There's situations where I'm literally telling families who I've been with since they were in seventh grade, and I'm like, I don't want nothing from you. Like, I'm good. God has blessed me. I'm good with what I have. Let me help guide you through your career. Like, I know what this is. I've been a part of 6 pre-drafts. I've been a part of NBA training for multiple summers. I know NBA GM scouts. I know all these people. I know I know somebody from every single agency.
I'm pretty
sure, like, Major, I think it's my first time meeting someone from your agency. I'm meeting you, you know what I mean? Like, I know, let me help you. And they're like, somebody with a brand comes around, who's been around it, like you said, and they just know better than me all of a sudden. But I see the kids get into situations that I'm like, that's not for you. I know you.
That's
maybe for a player who is a 5-star. You're a 5-star player, but that situation is not for you. And I see it. I've seen it happen so many times because I'm the middle school coach. And kids go to the wrong colleges. Kids go to the wrong high schools, transfer to the wrong high schools. Like, man, just talk to the person who's been in your corner, and I don't want nothing from you. And I think that's what it is. Like, I don't want nothing from them. Like, does Todd really know? Is he doing this to get leverage? No. If I want to go work for an agency, I know where to go. If I want to go and use who I know or whatever to get leverage, I'll go do that. I just want to help.
That's the hardest part about that is that the people that genuinely want to help, I don't want to like, and again, I'm not making like a blanket statement that this always happens, but it feels like the people that have the strongest opinions are probably getting something, and the families maybe don't even know that that's happening, right? As opposed to just relying on the people that have already been there and then finding ways to keep those people around, like include them in it. Like, it's, to me, it's like, I'm saying this as an agent, it's like never really been fair to me when I see a player, they're like, these people that have helped them and genuinely care about them are kind of like left out because they don't have their hand out, right? And the agency's not looking to necessarily add anybody in. They're like, okay, cool, you're not asking me to do anything with that person, come on, I'll represent you. And now they're making like a lot of money. I mean, the NBA, the business is really good, and like the people that have helped, you know, it's not even thought about to figure out how to include them in like the next step of the journey, right?
Most agencies try to weed those people out. You see it all the time.
100%,
and,
yeah.
And my point is like that, just, and this is on both sides, right? So from my side, if I'm with a player and they actually do help me guide them to college or guide them to the pros, once you're in good hands, I'll leave you alone. Like, if I... I'm like, hey, go work with EJ, and then, hey, he's taking care of you. You don't need me anymore. I got you to your spot. My my goal is to be a part of somebody's journey, not be the reason that somebody made it.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. But I think it's like what, and this is, again, this is my personal opinion, is like there's not enough of like, because the structure of a lot of these agencies, like they can't really afford to do it. If they do it for one, then they feel like they gotta do it for everybody.
Yeah.
Right? And so my thing is like, you should have a focus on like, if you are making X amount of dollars and you are having level of success, or you have some sort of platform, is like, how could you go back and give back to the programs, right? And that doesn't mean that this is like some kind of like cash grab or something to that effect, right? But there's so much of that bad stuff going on, is that when the good people are trying to be involved in some way, it's almost like awkward, because you're like, I don't want to be seen as that, because like, I actually do really care. But like going back and being like, all right, how do I invest in the program, or how do I add to where I came from, right? And that could be anything from a middle school program to like the community that you grow in, like grew up in. And a lot of times, like, players want to do that, they want to, but they don't have the people around them that are encouraging them to do it, because a lot of agents or agencies take the approach of like, if he ain't asking me, I ain't gonna say it, right? I don't want to do more work. Whereas like, I'm taking more of the approach of like, you should be thinking about this at the right time, like get yourself established, right? But like at a certain point, like think about like how much impact you can make, and you can make it right now because you are currently in the NBA versus when you're a former, it's different when you're a former NBA player. Like right now, these kids or this community, whatever, needs you, and they can turn the TV on and see you in an NBA jersey running up and down the court making shots, right? Whereas like when it's over, it just doesn't have the same kind of gravity.
Yeah, not for sure. Great point. Oh. Karina, any Karina questions?
Yes. It's to piggyback off of what
we're not gonna flip the camera?
I did. Well, no. It's too much time.
Okay, I'll do it. All right.
Kind of the same question that you asked about, but for you, because you were waiting tables and about to start like the journey to where you are now, and obviously you still have more dreams and goals.
Yeah.
If you could give yourself any advice when you first started, what would you give yourself?
I would say you're good at this. You can do this. Like, don't wait so long to have the confidence that you can do this, because I think so much of it was like, there was a level of insecurity. I was like, I was getting into this business and I thought I knew it, but I wanted to be sure that I knew it, because I didn't, as a filmmaker, from like the perspective of a player, like I was like so nervous that if I like overstated my abilities, that I would somehow be doing a disservice to the player. And I don't think that I would tell myself to overstate your abilities, but be like really confident that you can do this and you can really help guys. And there's going to be proof of that. There's going to be proof of that, but don't wait so long to believe that.
Man, so normally on this show, I do, this is therapy for the person sitting in that chair. The last couple episodes have been therapy for me. Yeah. I'm going to lie. 24-second shot clock, let the people know where they can find you and social media and all that, and just a message for the people.
My Instagram, Twitter is at EJ Kushner. You can get, I'm doing CBA videos. I work for Icona Agency. You can see what we're doing there. I work with Diana Day, incredible partner, someone who's been there, done that, built the best boutique agency, helped build the best boutique agency, in my opinion, in the history of agent business. And yeah, follow our journey there. I'm excited what we're building and what's to come next.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much, man, for coming on the show.
Thank you, man.
All right. That's all we have for you today, folks. We'll see you next time. Peace.